From FingerLakes1.com, you're listening to a Sunday Conversation. This week, we dive into the world of vaccines with two medical professionals from the Finger Lakes Health family, Dr. Grace Fryer and Christina Redding, a nurse from Life Care Medical Associates. Help us understand their position, which is that vaccines are not only safe, but crucial to public health. We dive into herd immunity, how that works, and what changes at the state level to religious exemption mean for those in upstate New York. We also get into the mechanics of how conversations about vaccines happen between medical professionals and parents. That whole interview is coming up next, right after a quick message from the FingerLakes1.com team. Being too busy to read the newspaper or watch the evening news doesn't mean you have to be uninformed. FingerLakes1.com has been providing expansive local coverage from across the region for 20 years. No paywall, no pop-up ads, just news delivered 24/7 all year long to your smartphone, tablet, or desktop computer. Visit patreon.com/FL1 to learn how to become a monthly contributor to help keep FingerLakes1.com growing and informing the Finger Lakes. Doctor, let's start with you, herd immunity. Walk us through what that is and why that's so important when we're talking about immunizations and vaccines and things like that.
The key number for herd immunity is 95%. So if 95% of the population is vaccinated for a certain disease, then it protects the 5% that cannot be vaccinated for medical reasons. There's enough protection in the community where you will prevent an outbreak, and you will prevent the people who cannot be vaccinated from being exposed to any of that disease. So if 95% of the population is vaccinated for, let's say, polio, then it should not be in the community enough to harm other people who cannot be vaccinated.
I'm sure you get this question all the time. Are vaccines safe? What makes a vaccine safe? And I guess asking the doctor in the room, I'm curious what that process looks like, the vetting process essentially. Talk about the science a little bit if you can behind how a vaccine becomes a vaccine so that, you know, the patients that you're dealing with are receiving them.
So one of the oldest vaccines is the measles vaccine that was discovered in 1963, and there's been at least 40 years of experience and safety to isolate the virus and to attenuate it, to kill it, to make it less harmful in order to prevent the disease from spreading. It's been prepared and studied to its highest safety. Right. And we've actually combined it to make it more convenient to the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella. So what it's done is actually prevented outbreaks and actually eliminated measles in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. There's been so many studies that have shown it to be safe through the CDC. We've have a schedule to be given at 12 months, and again, a booster needed at 4 years of age. And that gives you lifelong immunity to measles, mumps, and rubella. There's been some concerns about the association with autism, but that has been completely dispelled. People were concerned about thimerosal or mercury, which is a preservative, and that has also been removed. And so there's been thousands of patients have been studied to show that MMR vaccine is not associated with autism.
And yet we still see some reservation. Obviously, the religious exemption is something that now is really being discussed, and I'm sure you guys are fielding a lot of questions about that. But in general, what are some of the sort of modern day reservations among parents and other folks who, you know, they hear, really they're getting a flood of information through the internet and through the various news stories that are popping up online, legitimate and otherwise. What are some of those reservations that you see the most that you have to sort of explain away?
I think they're worried about getting too many too soon. Mm-hmm. We have so many advances in the technology now that we could prevent measles, mumps, rubella. We could prevent polio. We have vaccines for chickenpox. We have vaccines for Haemophilus influenza, pneumococcal disease, HPV, tetanus, whooping cough. There's been so many medical advances that we are trying to prevent these diseases, and there's a lot of vaccines available. So I think as a parent, you're wondering, you know, are all these shots necessary? And they are definitely necessary, and they're definitely safe to protect our children. Out in the third world, we see all these diseases that cause devastating illnesses, deaths. So now that we have this technology and availability, we definitely want to profit from it, from protecting our children. So too many too soon. These vaccines have actually been made more efficient to have less antigens to do the to have your best bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. So even though we're thinking we're giving maybe three shots, you know, for a 2-month-old, it really doesn't have a lot of antigens to cause any problems at all. It protects the child with less substance that we used to have back in the 1960s.
Right. So I guess the follow-up question to that is there any surprise at all within the medical community that, one, we're dealing with measles again, and two, that you're having to have sort of these conversations despite how far the vaccines themselves have legitimately come?
Unfortunately, it's not surprising. I think the parents, you know, they want to take on, you know, much more of an active role in the care of their children. They are rightfully want to do the right thing for their kids. They want to ask the right questions. Unfortunately, there's a fear factor that's stopping them from taking good advice and protecting their kids. There's a lot of media, unfortunately, a lot of misinformation. Unfortunately, a lot of, you know, people who mistrust the government and mistrust, you know, the people telling them that this is the best thing for their child. Of course, they should do their own research and ask the right questions to their own pediatrician, their own provider. But in the end, it really is the medical community is trying to protect and help their children.
So how does that, and I want to shift over to Christina here, how does that conversation start, or where does that conversation normally start, and how do you sort of broach the topic without making parents or anyone else uncomfortable in the process?
Well, the first thing is I see myself as the first point of contact. So if parents have questions, a lot of times they'll call into the office ahead of time and ask some of those questions, or we have the conversations when they come into the office, because I'm usually the one to get them and room them and start that initial conversation. So I see myself as an educator. I think that's my most important role. One of the most important things that I think I do is I hear them, I listen to them. I can be an active listener. I can, you know, take all of their concerns down and pass them on to Dr. Fryer. I can answer questions that I feel comfortable asking, but if they're looking for, you know, specific medical knowledge, I usually defer that to her. But a lot of times these parents, they're just fearful, and they just want to know that their concerns are being heard. And sometimes that's enough. That's all it takes to help them understand that if, you know, ultimately they decide to vaccinate, we feel like they're doing the right thing for their child. You know, they come in with hesitation. Sometimes they still leave with some hesitation, but more often than not, if they feel like they've been listened to and their concerns have been addressed, I would say most of the time they will go forward with the vaccines. Mm-hmm. So that's, I see my role as that of an educator.
And to that end, obviously, a single visit to the doctor's office doesn't always take a long time. It could be 15, 20 minutes. It could be 10 minutes. It could be an hour. Mm-hmm. Does it sometimes take a couple visits, a couple exposures to this kind of dialogue, this conversation, before parents or guardians start to warm up to the prospect of maybe introducing vaccines to their children, and maybe they didn't come in with that attitude.
Absolutely. I think it varies from family to family. We run the gamut where some families come in fully prepared to vaccinate their children. They just want to know from us what's recommended at that particular visit, so we give them that information and they say, yes, I want to go ahead with that. To the you know, families that absolutely don't want to vaccinate at all, and then we have everything in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I think depending on where they are on that spectrum is going to determine how many visits or how much time it's going to take for them to have their questions answered and be comfortable with their decisions.
And one of the common questions that we saw coming into this was a little bit of curiosity from the general public in terms of how many people actually fall into this uncertain category. Because, you know, in talking to some parents and talking to some other folks in the medical community leading up to this, there seemed to be a lot of just assumption that the science is good, everything is good, we can get the vaccines. Most people think that way. So how does it sort of break down? What percentage of the patients that you're seeing or ordinarily seeing fall into this, I'm really not sure, category?
It's a good question. We have a large, diverse community, including the Mennonite community. Mm-hmm. So I want to say in our practice, maybe 50% are... We have a conversation where we talk about each vaccine, whether or not they want to go with, you know, the chickenpox vaccine or not. That's a big one in the Mennonite community that they're hesitant about. They're probably okay with all the other ones, tetanus, mm-hmm. polio. So we have a large variety of patients who do one at a time, who modify the schedule or go straight through with the CDC recommended schedule that protects their child the best they can. We do recommend that because we don't want anybody to be basically unprotected. But we definitely work with our patients. There's definitely been several conversations where we introduce, you know, a vaccine and they think about it and they do it the next visit after mm-hmm. verifying with their family or conferring with their basically grandparents, husband, wife. Mm-hmm. Community to make sure that they're doing the right thing for themselves as well, for the community as well.
So when you mentioned sort of modifying the schedule, sometimes parents will opt to do a different schedule than the traditional outline. What sort of challenges does that pose, not only on your guys' side, but also on the sort of public health side? Does that pose any risk sort of modifying the schedule, or eventually do the kids get there soon enough where it just doesn't matter that much?
It absolutely poses a risk, unfortunately. The tetanus vaccine is scheduled to be given at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. It's a combination with the whooping cough vaccine. And that protects our 2-month-olds from older family members who may have had the whooping cough and have been coughing for months and mm-hmm. don't know it. Doesn't affect them as much as they would because they're older, and now it's affecting the 2-month-old baby. So we've actually had quite a few cases of whooping cough in our community because they're delaying vaccines. Some people are giving it at age 1 or age 4 or even just before school starts. And unfortunately, that leaves basically a 2-month to 6-year-old unprotected child. because we our office policy does not exclude patients because of not following the right or the CDC recommended schedule, it does cause a little bit of a predicament, because every child that comes in, we have to see what they're due for, what the length between the first and the second vaccine is. It's very individualized. Mm-hmm. So Christine and I always confer, and we have a wonderful asset through something called NYSIS, New York State System Immunization Program, and it gives us a good, it has all the dates and tells us when a patient is due. As long as that's updated, that gives us a good reference to decide what shot to give next. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we work with the parent and see what they're comfortable with.
So one of the follow-ups that just popped in my head, what does the number look like by the time a child is ready for kindergarten or to start school? How many vaccines has that child had in total, or how many immunizations has that child had typically? It's sort of the average number.
26?
Mm-hmm. And is that one of those numbers that sort of maybe when a parent or maybe a first-time parent is going through this process, when they first hear that number, your child is going to get this many immunizations or shots before they start? Is that one of the things that sort of unsettles them maybe?
I don't know, because that number doesn't come up very often. We talk about vaccines from the moment they're in our office, 3 days old, 2 weeks old. They're not ready for vaccines at that point, but we talk about their next visit's going to be at 2 months. We'll start getting the first set of vaccines. And usually most parents are fine with that because we know that's going to protect them. The reason why we have so many vaccines, and it sounds like a big number, is a child under age of one has a very fragile and young immune system. So we have to give them their vaccine at age 2 months to protect them from whooping cough, tetanus, hemophilus influenza, and pneumococcal at that moment. And then 2 months later, their body forgets it. So we have to boost them up again at 4 months old. So really you're protecting them like a blanket throughout their first year of life. Once that blanket falls off, they're unprotected. You have to put it back on them. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, people who have had children before, I think it's a routine. It's part of their visit. We make sure that development, their height and weight, everything is developing normally, and we do their vaccines to protect them. That number of shots is really not, it sounds like a lot, but it's really not that much. We used to give vaccines where there's 3,000 or thousands of antigens in each vaccine, and now for those 26, it's a total of 160. And an antigen is basically a particle, and in just a bacteria itself, there's 6,000 antigens that you're exposed to when you're infected with strep throat or have an ear infection or just basically a cold virus. So these small antigens that are in the vaccine are literally just a drop in the bucket when we give it to them, even throughout their first 5 years of life.
Mm-hmm. And sort of running through that, the age range there, things are sort of most unstable for the child between year zero and one, and then things start to simmer down a little bit?
So their immune system is very, very young, of course, through age zero and one. But it is the less than 5-year-olds who are the most vulnerable for any of those vaccines. Mm-hmm. Sorry, any of those diseases.
Right.
For instance, for measles, it is less than 5-year-old children that have the highest mortality and morbidity. Mm-hmm. So we do want to protect any of the children. Also, flu. Kids under the age of 5 can die from flu. We've had, 100 cases of children die from flu each year.
So let's talk a little bit about the religious exemption change for New York State. Obviously, I'm sure you guys are getting a lot of questions on this. So what kind of conversations are you having to have with parents about the change, and what's that sort of protocol look like for you guys now compared to what it did last year before the change occurred?
So it's affecting the schools the most because they have basically eliminated the non-medical exemption to go to school for vaccines. We have to catch kids up who had a religious exemption who want to continue to attend school. So they call into Christina, mm-hmm. and they say, what do I need to do to start school? And the rule states that we have to have one vaccine from each series before they can start in September, within 2 weeks of the start date of their school. After that, they need to have a schedule lined up to catch them up for the rest of the vaccines, and that appointment list needs to be given to the school within 30 days of starting school. Mm-hmm. And it's quite the process.
Okay, so to that end, are we talking about a situation where sometimes students or children are delaying starting school or missing parts of school because they are not up to par or up to that point in the schedule where they need to be?
I don't think we've gotten there yet because school hasn't started. So that will be a question when September runs around.
Okay, so I see what you're saying. So coming into this upcoming school year, it's sort of a new ball game for you guys.
It is. It's brand new. We are definitely catching up patients now before school starts. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge, but I think in the end it will protect our children. With the measles outbreak itself, I think that's what's really stemmed this non-medical exemption rescinding, because there's been 1,109 cases of measles in the United States this year from January 1st. And 619 is in New York City, mm-hmm. and 258 are in Rockland County.
Right.
So essentially 800 cases of the 1,000 is in New York State. And so I think New York State is really trying to, stop this outbreak as fast as they can.
So one of the criticisms, and I want to get both your takes on this, one of the criticisms of rescinding that particular part of it is that, it won't be enough. It won't be enough. So a lot of folks are pointing to there needing to be more community education, more sort of public service announcements and that sort of thing. Does that side of this need to catch up again, where this was something, where measles was something that was so far removed from the fronts of most people's minds that mm-hmm. we sort of need to go back to 1960 and think like we did then in terms of re-educating people, even though it may seem for maybe 50%+ of the population just completely unnecessary?
You want me to start? Go ahead.
I think what you just said is exactly the way that I usually approach it with parents when they come in. And I often end up talking about the situation with the measles in New York City because that's something that everyone's heard about and they can relate to. And I was actually just reading something that the governor had posted regarding his new legislation removing the non-medical exemptions. And his exact words, not to get into a political discussion or anything like that, but we don't have nearly enough time for that, was that this is just step one, and we need to solidify this step first and work on all of the things that you're saying, the public education and people consulting their own providers, their pediatricians, to get accurate information. I think it's important to keep in mind that we live in the age of social media, and that's where everybody gets their information from, and some of it is legitimate and some of it is not. So I think it's hard to dispel some of those myths, and people just have information coming at them from all different directions, and it's hard sometimes to sort that out, especially when you're talking about your children, who I would say most parents feel are their most precious investment. So, I think it's important just to be mindful of that they're having information coming at them from all over, and we have to just try to do our best to present them with the facts. But definitely, this is step one of many, because there are other diseases out there that we want to protect these children from. But when you think about measles, that is a disease that was nearly eradicated, and now we're seeing it again in large proportion. So we want to try to move forward on that.
And of course, social media was one of the things that kept coming up whenever this conversation was had, because that's where a lot of this misinformation is being spread now, not nearly as much just across the web, but where a large portion of the population is spending a whole lot of time on social media. Mm-hmm. Given how difficult it can be sometimes to sort of cut through the noise of Facebook and Twitter and these social platforms, does that, from the medical community standpoint, does it feel a little bit daunting, a little bit overwhelming to try and cut through that noise in a way that, you're not losing the substance, because it's pretty complicated stuff too at the same time, right?
It basically has to be a one-on-one conversation with each parent. There is a lot of noise. Fortunately, it's the negative stories and the fears that get promoted faster than the positive ones. So really, when a parent has a concern in the office, I make sure they understand what each vaccine is about, why it's safe, what I do for my kids, which is follow the CDC recommendation, and tell them that I highly recommend it and feel strong that this will protect their child from these diseases, and really get down to what I've seen in my medical practice, what we've prevented when it comes to meningitis. Now we have a meningitis vaccine that we can prevent severe diseases. I've seen children in the PICU for, you know, months, and I really try to tell them that we have so much experience with bad diseases that I can highly recommend these vaccines to prevent them. And I think that really helps, because the stories that they see on Facebook or Twitter or wherever it is, they're sensationalized, but they're not personal. So if we can talk to them personally, I think it really does help.
So then, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about measles, and we've spent quite a bit of time talking about measles here. But what are some of the other sort of common vaccines that people should be aware of and sort of should have on their radar, so that we don't see another sort of have a repeat of the same situation play out again in the future?
So one of the newer recommendations that are required for school is a meningitis vaccine I just mentioned. We used to give it basically before they entered college. That was a recommendation, 17, 18 year olds. But unfortunately, we're seeing the meningitis disease at age 15, younger ages. So now we're recommending them at age 11. So before your child goes to sixth grade, you have to have a tetanus and a meningitis vaccine. And that's preventing severe disease that's occurring earlier on. It protects you for at least 5 years. You get a booster again at 16 years of age. And we've gotten rid of, you know, a huge amount of meningitis. Meningitis, the bacteria, can be stored in the back of your throat and your nose as a carrier for 10 to 15% of the population. So when you go into a camp situation or military or a college situation where you have not been exposed to it, you're not a carrier and other people are, and all of a sudden, you know, they're sharing that bacteria with you, you can get sick very quickly. And meningitis will give you, of course, headache, terrible rash, and, you know, sepsis, and, you know, eventually almost death, or death itself. So those are one of the great advances we've had. We started the vaccine at age 11, and now we're boosting at 16. We have a new vaccine called Bexsero or Trememba, which is a meningitis B vaccine that's also preventing a different serotype. We've protected our children against four different serotypes, A, C, W, and Y, and now there's a new one for B that is very rare, but also very devastating. So you don't even get 24 hours before you get a prodrome and decide that it's gonna really hit you. So that's recommended before you go to college. Children are three times more likely to get exposed to meningitis B in college situations. So we really are trying to protect our children at adolescence and beyond.
And, you know, every year we have this discussion. We have some folks from Finger Lakes Health come in and we talk about the flu shot. We talk about the flu,
sure,
and how far that has come. But the interesting thing is, or at least what we found this past winter, was as this measles debate started to pop up and the measles vaccine debate started to pop up, we started to see some folks say, well, yeah, I get the flu shot every year, but that doesn't mean I want every vaccine. So I'm sure you've had these conversations before with parents, family members, the whole nine yards. Walk us through how you sort of guide through that scenario compared to someone who just doesn't want any vaccines at all. Obviously, it's someone who sees, they must see the benefit to some degree. Is it a little easier to get them into a place where they're comfortable and understand what's really happening and the science behind it?
So the flu vaccine is different because the flu virus itself changes year to year. Mm-hmm. And there are several flu types, and we can't unfortunately protect against all of them. We do the best we can by predicting what flu virus will be available or in the community in our area at that time. We actually look at different areas of the world, in Australia, and see in their winter situation what comes from there, and then we could predict what will come to the United States. So it is not as solid and effective as the other vaccines. So there is only one chickenpox vaccine, and there's only one chickenpox virus, and we definitely could protect against that up to 95%. For the flu, it is sometimes as good as 50%. And that's going to be a parental or a personal decision whether or not you want to get that vaccine. Mm-hmm. I personally get the flu vaccine every year because as a provider, I'm being exposed to it every year, mm-hmm. and my children as well, I give it to them every year. I'd rather protect them even 50% of the chance if I can before they get the flu. The more people we vaccinate, the better. So if we could promote, you know, again, 95% of the population to get the flu vaccine, then sure, we will reduce the flu in the community as best as we can. But 50%, you know, of the time, we may not be protected. So there is a chance that you can still get the flu. When I talk about the flu vaccine, it's I don't feel as strongly because it is less predictable. Mm-hmm. But I continue to promote it because I, you know, want to give everybody the best chance they can to be protected for that year.
And I, what I want to close with is just kind of what the, because I would assume new parents, they're getting bombarded with a lot of information, a lot of recommendations, a lot of advice, solicited and otherwise.
Correct.
What's the elevator pitch? What's the elevator pitch for why folks, parents, guardians, family members, everyone should get vaccines, period, across the board, as opposed to not?
So I guess to me, the way that I try to present it, especially to newer parents, is let's get your child off on the right path. Let's get them started on the right foot. Because they're just exposed to so much and they're so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, none of this is a perfect science, like we were just talking about with the flu vaccine. There's some variation. 50% of the population may get the flu even if they get, you know, if they're vaccinated. But ultimately, this is the best and proven, backed by science, protection we have for our children. So it's a gift that you can give them, and you can start them off on the right track right from the beginning. You know, I feel like I spend a lot of time talking with parents. As a nurse, that's what we do. We educate. We're teachers first, really. I print off vaccine information sheets for them all the time. We give them with every vaccine. I don't want anything to be a secret. I want them to be aware and be fully informed. So I do everything that I can to make sure that that happens for them. And hopefully that'll make it a little bit easier for them each time they come in. I let them know what to expect at the next visit. You know, next time this is what we're going to be doing. So I think that, you know, I think that that does make a difference if they're open to it from the beginning. But definitely they are bombarded with a lot of information. So the other thing that I say to parents a lot that I think everyone should keep in mind in the general public is that when you talk about vaccines, yes, you're vaccinating your own children to protect them, but by doing that, you're protecting other people in the community that may not be able to receive these vaccines and are extremely vulnerable because they have medical reasons for, you know, say they can't be vaccinated for measles. So, you know, you're protecting your own child, but you're also contributing to that herd immunity that we were talking about, and you're doing your part to protect other members of the community, the elderly, young children that can't receive those vaccines yet, or medically compromised. So there's just a lot of different components to all of this talk about vaccine, and, you know, for me personally, I just want people to know that, you know, they should contact their own providers, and hopefully they have the ability to have their concerns heard, and hopefully we can give them the information they need to be comfortable with their decisions.
If you have a question, ask it. That's the moral of the story right here today. Thank you both for coming in today. Hey guys, thanks for listening this week. All of our Sunday conversations are available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the FingerLegs1.com app. Download the app and become a subscriber for more podcasts like this one. You can also support what we're doing here by becoming a Patreon member. Just $1 a month can help ensure local content like this continues to thrive and grow. Visit patreon.com/FL1 to sign up today. Have a great week, and I will talk to you all next Sunday.